First reading is from Genesis 37, from verse 12 to 24.
Genesis 37, 12 to 24, and that's on page 13 of the Church Bibles. That's Genesis 37, 12 to 24. Now Joseph's brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said to him, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields. And the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I am seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock." And the man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him. And we will see what will become of these dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore. And they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it.
Thanks, Akimi. We're going to carry straight on from where we were. So, verse 24, I think it is. 25. Then they sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. They took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go?" Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "This we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not." He identified it and said, "It is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his only son, for his son, for many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. It'd be a help to me if you keep that open, and there's some headings as well. We're doing this little series, which we're calling, I'm struggling with this clicker. This is my secret signal when I need a new slide, so I'll do this. So can we have next slide? We're looking at a series called Where is God in a Messed Up World? It's going to take us all the way through the story of Joseph. We're in the final section of Genesis. And in particular, we're going to be thinking about where is God in a brutal crime? So this is probably the most famous public brutal crime of recent years. In fact, it's the one where, if you were alive in 2001... most of us will remember exactly where we were when we heard about this, the 9/11 disaster. And immediately after it happened, one writer wrote this: suppose there was someone who could control the wind, the rain, and the lightning. And suppose he governed all these things. And suppose that he allowed thousands of men and women and babies to be crushed shapeless. What would we think of such a savage? And yet, Christians tell us, this precisely describes their God. When bad things happen, and when they're brutal, especially when it's on a massive scale, like 9/11, or even when it's actually on a personal scale, in our own lives or in the lives of those around us, are we really going to say that God is in control of these kinds of events? Or even, and this is what the passage that we're looking at today says, or this section of Genesis rather, that at some level God even purposes these terrible events for good ends. Can I say that this whole issue, it's a very serious issue, God's relationship to human suffering, it's not just a theoretical issue. You know, it's something to be debated in philosophical classrooms. This is an issue that matters for every single one of us in the room. I read recently that Kemi Badenoch, the leader of the opposition, she was brought up in the faith in Nigeria. She left it all behind precisely because of this question, the question of how can there be a God of love in the face of all the terrible evil we see in this world? For some, they come up to this question and then they leave the faith completely. That was Kemi Badenoch's experience. For others, there's a huge temptation actually towards bitterness when something terrible happens. One father has written this: on July the 4th, 1995, my multiply disabled son entered the world, and the world came crashing down around me and would soon include a deep and intense bitterness towards God. I never denied that God existed or that he's powerful. I just concluded that he's mean and capricious. And so whoever we are, we need to think this topic through. And I'm going to suggest today that we need to get the anchors in place before the storm hits. That's my prayer for today, that as a result of this time in this room, each of us would be better equipped with anchors in place for when those storms hit, and they will hit. In this section of the Bible, we're looking at the life of Joseph, it's filled, and I said this last week as I was introducing it, with all kinds of horrors, terrific sin and suffering and injustice. Then you get to the end of the section in chapter 50, and this was our theme verse at the beginning of the service, we see Joseph, who looks back on this whole section. And particularly, he looks back on the events of today's chapter, this brutal crime. And it's on the front of your sheets. It's chapter 50, verse 20. It's also on the screens. And he says, as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. We've had that repeated. I'm hoping, actually, that we'll get so used to this that it will become a sort of memory verse, and we'll be able to carry it with us. It's an amazing verse. And it's a reflection from this guy, Joseph, who really knew suffering and who really knew his God. And it's a reflection over life, reflecting on these things, on how these two realities exist together. And I just noticed first that the language of evil that we get in that verse, did you notice it? You meant evil. And I want to pick that out because there is a movement in our society to reduce everything down to merely medical or therapeutic explanations. So the most that we could say about a behavior is that was an antisocial behavior, or it's part of a dysfunction, or it's a disorder. The Bible, on the other hand, recognizes there is such a thing as right and wrong, and there is therefore such a thing as human evil. And therefore it just names it. You meant evil against me. And yet, did you notice that God didn't just allow this evil and then try his best to do something good out of what happened? You know, you imagine the master chess player trying to respond as best he can to what's thrown at him and try and get round it. No, Joseph says, in some way, God actually meant it. That's the language of the verse. He intended it at some level. He planned it and he purposed it for good. So God, right from the beginning, he had a bigger and higher purpose behind the wicked tragedy, which was, and the verse says, to bring it about that many should be kept alive as they are today. So this was God's means to get Joseph ahead of the brothers to Egypt so that he could do this wonderful thing of saving the brothers' lives, in fact, the lives of the known world, by providing bread. So we've got 2 points today, and I've kind of organized it so that they kind of loosely correspond to the two halves of that verse, chapter 50, verse 20. Point one, it's on your sheets, the seemingly random mess of life, and that one corresponds to you meant evil against me. It's all the stuff that goes wrong. And then the second point is planned by God for our ultimate blessing. And that one's meant to correspond to, and God meant it for good. God's behind it, using it for blessing. So let's look at number one, the seemingly random mess of life. And in particular, we're going to look at the chance event. Now, in verses 13 to 14, we saw this last week, actually. Jacob, he's the patriarch, he sends his favorite son, Joseph, on a dangerous mission. And the mission is to check up on these thuggish older brothers. Then we have the curious section, verses 15 to 17, which actually could be from verse 13 and still makes sense. It makes you scratch your head. What is 15 to 17 here for? Why is it in the Bible? It's actually a good question in any Bible study. What is this chunk here for? What would we lose if it wasn't in the Bible? Let me read it. Verse 15. And a man found Joseph wandering in the fields. And the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I'm seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where they're pasturing the flock." And the man said, "They've gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. So these verses are about just a chance encounter that Joseph has while he's just wandering out in the fields. And then Joseph has a conversation over here of a conversation the brothers happen to have been having. And I want us to think about this. Over the next decade, actually more than a decade, which Joseph goes on to slavery and then in prison, Joseph must have replayed the events of this fateful day 1,000 times in his mind. He had a lot of time on his hand and he was always thinking about what happened on that terrible day. And every time he must have uttered the word, "If only. If only. If only I hadn't bumped into that guy in the field. If only I hadn't got talking to him. If only he hadn't overheard my brothers talking. If only, if only, if only. Then I wouldn't have actually caught up with my brothers and none of this tragedy would have happened to me." And I want to ask if any of us carry any if onlys in our lives. If only I hadn't done that. If only they hadn't done that thing to me. Then life could have been so, so different. But actually, at least by chapter 45... Joseph is able to look back on exactly these events and he's able to say to his brothers, God is the one who sent me before you to Egypt to preserve life. God did it. Joseph could see, even in these unfortunate chance events in this chapter, that actually God was the agent. He was the one at work. He was planning blessing for his people throughout all of this. In April 2001, a missionary couple, Jim and Veronica Bowers, they were sitting side by side with their two children, Corey and Charity, in a single engine plane over the jungles of Peru. And the Peru force mistook the missionary plane for a drug plane, and they opened fire. And the pilot's legs were shot, and he put the plane into an emergency dive, and he amazingly landed the plane in the countryside, but sadly not without tragic loss. One bullet had passed by Jim's head and made a hole in the windshield. Another bullet, sadly, passed through the wife Veronica's back and then stopped inside her seven-month-old baby. And that bullet killed both mother and child, both Veronica and Charity. And that is a dread chance event, isn't it? A stray bullet fired because someone misidentified a plane. What a terrible thing to happen. And you can only imagine the kind of if-onlys that go through a husband's and through a son's mind after an event like that. If only, if only. And yet only 2 weeks after that event, Jim Bowers, he stood in a room like this in front of 1,200 people. It was the memorial service for his wife and his baby daughter. And he spoke warmly about how he missed them and, you know, what a wonderful wife she was. And then he said this: "Most of all, I want to thank my God. He is a sovereign God. Could this really be God's plan for my wife Veronica and our baby Charity? God's plan for Corey, our son, and for our family? I'd like to tell you why I believe it is." And he then refers to the chance events by which God sovereignly sent his son to the cross, chance events which God used to bring about a plan of salvation. And the most phrase he used was this: "Veronica and Charity were instantly by the same bullet. That was a sovereign bullet." That was a sovereign bullet. I wanted to consider what is happening there. How is it that a husband and a father can speak that way about such a tragic and seemingly chaotic event? Does he know why God ordained for this to happen? Of course not. Does he know what good God might ultimately get out of the event? No, he doesn't. But he does know, especially actually because of the cross of Jesus, of a God. And he knows about a God who is sovereign and in control over even chance events, even stray bullets. And so he knows that in the midst of all the pain, there is a God he can trust, even in the midst of the horror. And so I want to suggest, if we are carrying around our own if-onlys, and there'll be lots in this room, can I suggest and encourage this perspective? This is the comfort that can come to us if we get in step with reality. We know this true God, the one who is both good and sovereign, and therefore one we can walk in and trust even in the difficulties. Well, you might be thinking, well, it's one thing, isn't it, to say that God may have been behind chance events, coincidences, that kind of thing in this chapter. But isn't it quite another thing that suggests that God is behind human evil and wrongdoing? Surely that's, you know, the bit of the puzzle God can't have control over. He's like the chess player responding. The best he can do is work with what is thrown at him. And that's the question we're going to consider next. And what these brothers do in this passage is definitely a wicked thing. You see it in verse 18. Their initial plan is murder, fratricide, murder of a brother. And it's only because they're convinced that there's more money in it for them in selling him, that's verse 26, that they end up handing him over to a band of human traffickers for 20 pieces of silver, there in verse 28. So it's a catalogue of human wickedness. And the ugliness of the crime is underlined by the most repeated word in the chapter. It's the word brother. 21 times in this chapter. Brother, 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 brother. And every time we hear it, it reminds us that what should be a bond of love and protection has been utterly violated. The very ones who should have been caring for him have gone out and abused him. Laura, our ministry trainee, she shared with me last week that this passage has had a particular resonance for her family, especially her father. Her father came out of a Muslim background in Egypt, came to Christian faith. It was his family who betrayed him to the authorities, and it led to him being imprisoned for faith, his own brothers. And this has been very special to him. And maybe you know something of that pain in your own life, what it is to be betrayed by family. And it seems there are at least two obvious motivations which draw these brothers. The other hatred, as if we said last week, they want to get rid of him. And the other obvious one is greed. They definitely love money, and they welcome the chance to make a bit of cash out of this situation. But strikingly, and we touched on this last week as well, there's another evil motive which drives these brothers. And that is not brother hatred, but God hatred. And we learned last week that God has declared a purpose through two dreams that many more people as well. He's kind of, we saw this last week, the Adam Mark II at the end of the book. He's going to do what Adam failed to do at the beginning and be the chosen ruler. And the reason the brothers couldn't just ignore these dreams, the reason they were so angry about them, seems to be that they knew the dreams were from God. They hated the idea of God appointing this man to rule over them, and they hated it so much they decided they were going to stop the plan. They were going to end God's plan once and for all. Look at verse 18. They saw Joseph from afar, and before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, here comes, what do they call him? This dreamer. It's his dreams that really this animal devoured him. Then we see what becomes of his dreams. Wahaha, you know. This is the villainous thing. We will put an end to these terrible ideas that God has put of this guy ruling. And I think there's something absurd here. Human beings, once they know that God has got a plan, to say, well, I know what, I know better than God, and I'm going to end God's plan. We're shaking our little puny fists at God, trying to stand against the purposes of Almighty God. It is absurd. And we saw this last week. This is the human condition. Psalm 2 says, why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain against the Lord and against his anointed? That means his Messiah, his appointed ruler. And this is the Bible's description of what the human condition is. It is open defiance, treason against the Creator who gives us everything. And how then does God respond? Well, we saw this last week. One of the ways God responds is to this open treason we saw last week is that he sends his chosen ruler, in this case Joseph, ultimately the greater Joseph, Jesus, we saw this, to willingly go after the ones who hate him. Here I am. But today's answer in our passage, how is God going to respond to this hatred against him, is that sometimes he demonstrates his wisdom and his power and his control by actually using his opponent's worst plans against them, in order to advance his own purpose. In this instance, God's intention, as we've seen, is that he wants to send Joseph ahead of the brothers to Egypt so that he can be raised up to save the brothers. How does God accomplish this wonderful plan? Well, he uses, and here's the thing, the brothers' worst plots against God's plan, selling Joseph into slavery, he uses their opposition to enable the plan to happen. Do you see what God is doing here? You may have heard of the Japanese martial art jiu-jitsu. Apparently it originated among samurai. Are there any jiu-jitsu practitioners here? I know there's quite a few martial arts people amongst us. I don't know much about this. I ended up sitting at the wedding on Monday next to Joao's best man, and he is a jiu-jitsu expert. And he confirmed to me what I thought it was about, which is, jiu-jitsu isn't really about confronting an opponent with your force and dominating them. The whole art of jiu-jitsu is based on manipulating the attacker's force against themselves. So they come at you, and you use their strength against them. And this is kind of how God is acting here. God is demonstrating his wisdom, his power, and he's using it by using his opponent's best efforts against him, and then he uses that to accomplish his own victory. And the wonderful thing is that the victory is the salvation of the very ones who hate him. That is the kind of God we're working with here. We already thought last week about how Joseph's life, in so many ways, and this was in the children's talk, wasn't it? It points us forward to the Lord Jesus, the greater Joseph to come. And this is another example, actually, of how Genesis is preparing us for what to expect when the Messiah comes. This is the way the opposition against Jesus is explained in Acts. This is the New Testament, Acts 4. The believers are gathered together, they're addressing God in prayer, and they say, "For truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel." So they're describing in prayer what is going on. There's a united, coordinated Jew-Gentile opposition to God. The nations are raging against God, as we tend to do. The enemies of God all point guns at God's king. And what do they achieve? Well, we read on. "Gathered together to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place." Isn't that extraordinary? All they achieve, all their plots against Jesus and against his church, and they end up doing exactly what God had planned for them to do. Crucified, and they unlocked the salvation of the world. That's what they achieved on that day. And so the cross shows us, doesn't it, that even the worst opposition to God's purposes is planned by God for his people's ultimate blessing. God is a jiu-jitsu specialist. We see this foreshadowed in the life of Joseph. We see it fulfilled in the cross of Jesus Christ. And actually, this pattern is one God uses over and over again. That's the reason they're praying here in Acts 4. "God, you know how this is what you love to do. Can you do it again, please?" And then he does it again. He does it again and again through history. And what this means for you and for me is we don't have to be those who try and avoid opposition at all costs. If you're anything like me, you probably fear the cost of being loyal to Christ. You know, what if I'm cancelled? What if I lose my reputation and my friends, my job prospects, or into the world, and some of us know this all too well, what if I lose my life? And yet the point here is that whatever is thrown at us, we know God is an expert at using his enemy's worst attacks to further his own purposes for blessing. This is classic God. This is vintage God. And he loves doing it again and again. This is actually what has inspired martyrs over hundreds and hundreds of years of Christian history, knowing that this will be a terrible thing, but I know God will bring good out of it. And so they lay down their lives. I think I mentioned before my friend Ben's experience. This is not a martyrdom experience. It's much more trivial than that. But Ben works in the city. And he wanted a few years ago to share Jesus with his colleagues. So what he did is he works in investment, put a little leaflet, a little flyer on each of the desks where he works. And it had a picture of Warren Buffett, who at the time was like the hero of investment. And the little leaflet said, "How to invest for eternity." And it was just to try and, you know, an opportunity to tell like financial geeks all about Jesus. And his workplace got very, very cross about this, and it was very humiliating for him. He got summoned before the bosses, and they demanded that he go round and individually apologize to everyone on that floor. And the company were trying to kind of crack down on God talk at work, and they wanted to make an example of him. But of course, nearly everyone Ben went round to talk to, and you can imagine what happened. They were all really grateful for the flyer. You know, it was very thoughtful of you, and they really wanted to know what had motivated him to do such a thing. And so one by one, he had to go around the whole floor and have conversations over several weeks. And what happened was there was way more gospel fruit than it ever could have, you know, promoted without, you know, his bosses demanding that he do that. And this is vintage God. This is classic God. He loves to use the opposition against him and then flip it and turn it for good. It's the jiu-jitsu move. Right, I'm getting slightly ahead of myself here, but so let's get back to the chapter. And as we read through this catalogue of cruelty and hatred, as readers, aren't we? What is it to plan this chapter? It looks like God is, and it feels like it. It looks like just wicked people running the show. And then at the last verse of the chapter, it reminds us, and this is the final point, that actually all of this, as the heading says, has been planned by God for our blessing. Let me read the last verse, verse 36. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold Joseph in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. At this stage, we're a long way actually from the end of the story, and Joseph's dreams in particular are a long way from finally getting fulfilled. But even here at the end of a very, very dark passage, we get just this little ray of light shooting in, and we discover in verse 36 that Joseph is now, he's one person away from the most powerful man in the world, the great King Pharaoh, the guy who has the power to change everything for Joseph and who will one day will. And so we're just getting a little hint here that through all of these seemingly chaotic events in this chapter, God is behind it and he's bringing Joseph through it. And indeed, he's bringing Joseph one step closer to fulfilling God's master plan of bringing salvation to his people, which he will. I'm thinking the danger each of us has when hard times come. And the danger is that temptation. We either doubt God is there and in control. That was like the 9/11 guy, there can be no good God in charge of this world. Or there's another temptation to doubt God's goodness, like that guy with the multiply disabled child. God is there, he's just cruel. And what you and I need to do is we need to settle these issues in our own hearts. And we need to settle these issues before the storm hits. And so that when we get that life crisis, doesn't at the same time become a faith crisis on top of it. And therefore, we need to tie on, I suggest, to two rock-solid moorings. We're like a boat. We could drift around, float, be flipped around in the storm, but we need two strong mooring points. Number one is God's sovereign power. He really is in control of every detail of history. He's in control of all those if-only events. Even in control of human evil, he's fully in charge. And also we need to tie on to this second mooring, which is God's goodness, his lavish kindness to his dear people. A goodness that means that these, even as these brothers are doing their worst, doing their utmost to oppose God, what's God doing? Well, he's working through it all to bless them. These thugs, the very people who hate him so much, all of this is for their benefit. God is a specialist, isn't he, of bringing good out of bad and bringing blessing out of cursing. Those who hate him get the benefit of this. Let me continue with a quote from John Knight. That was the guy at the beginning who entered. Thing that he wrote. And I think you can see kind of two mooring points he is clinging onto, that he's bound onto in the storm. So let me read. He says, I am often astonished when thinking back that I'm now able to praise God for his goodness in giving my son his autism and blindness. None of this happened easily or by accident. My pastor wrapped the words of the Bible around my heart. God used those words from the Bible, among many others, to create longings I didn't have, to start a dead heart beating and to reveal when I'm incapable of seeing the beauty, sufficiency, and majesty of Jesus Christ and his cross. God has done it all, and it was his word that was decisive. And then he goes on, living with a boy, now a teenager no less, who will always be dependent on someone for all his needs is very hard. I have a daily, often hourly fight for joy in my salvation. And yet through my oldest son's daily care, through my youngest son's premature birth, and now through my wife's ongoing battle with metastatic cancer, God is not just sustaining me, but he's revealing more of his goodness. Because he is powerfully sovereign over all these things for his glory and for my good. Extraordinary words. There is a guy who is attached to these two mooring points. Whatever storms hit him, God is in control and he's good, and I will trust him. I'm aware this isn't simply an emotive issue, but it's actually a very complex issue. And I want us to keep in mind what we saw at the beginning. There is such a thing as evil. There's more to say about this topic than just this chapter does. Bad things are not just good things looked at from a different angle. They are really evil. We don't have to pretend that, you know, always look on the bright side, or every cloud has a silver lining, or something like that. We can say, no, that is a terrible, horrific evil, and we can name it as such. And actually, the Bible has a bigger picture that acknowledges that suffering is actually only in this world because of the devil and because of human sin. And actually, that God's intention for the world is in eradication of all suffering and sin. This isn't just a good that we will learn to live with. It is a bad thing, and it will be eradicated. And actually, God entered into our suffering and absorbed it himself in order to secure this. So all those things are part of the full-orbed biblical picture, not just the truths of this passage. And what John Knight expresses for us here is the kind of strength and joy that comes from attaching ourselves to these mooring points. It comes from seeing that God is both powerful and good. And we need both those moorings securely in place. It's important to say that for Joseph, the clarity on what God was purposing through his suffering actually only came to Joseph in chapter 50, at the end of his story. Actually, that's the same for Job in the Bible. You might know the story of Job, who suffered terribly. Job didn't know what was going on in his story. We as readers know more than he does. It's similar, actually, in Christ's story. It was only after Christ's resurrection that the disciples started to realize what God was actually doing and what the cross had achieved. It happens at the end of the story. And the reality is that you and I, we live our lives, not again, but in the middle. And God may occasionally give those glimpses of what we're up to in our lives. But mainly we will have no, and we will understand what he's up to right at the end. And the point is that we are given these kind of accounts, the account of Joseph, the account of Job, the account of Jesus, so that we can understand the seemingly random mess of life, all the chance events, all the human evil. It is all planned by a good God for ultimate blessing. And what that means is we will still have questions. We'll still have lots of pain and confusion along the way. But the difference is that we know there is a God we can trust in the midst of it, and we can go to him, and we can look forward to the end of the story and trust him throughout. I'm going to leave a time of quiet, and I'd love for each of us to use the time to come before God. Maybe you've got an if only. Maybe this has been a painful talk for you because of some things in your life. Why not come honestly and tell him what you're feeling and ask for his help to put these mooring points in place? And then we'll have